Howdy, everyone, and welcome to Book Spider. Book Spider is a book of every other week podcast in which we read books and then discuss craft, theme, philosophy, and even go so far as to conjecture about the authorial intent from time to time. We also take care to package each episode of Book Spider with a number 33 rubber band and a tiny instructional manual so you can practice making rubber band art while you listen. This week's instructional manual shows you how to make the Batmobile and then turn the Batmobile into the rocket ship and then invert the rocket ship along its topological axis to make the dying man. My name is Chris Malmberg, and I'm joined, as always, by my two co-hosts, Patrick Barney and Hans Berger. This week, we're discussing the two most recent novels by Cormac McCarthy, The Passenger and Stella Maris. We're covering the two of them because they're intended, but are not required to be read together. Why exactly they aren't sold together as one novel is a question that I have. The Passenger is the larger of the two novels and the one we all read first. Are we supposed to read it first? Well, it came out first. Primarily, the action of The Passenger follows Bobby Western, a salvage diver who lives in New Orleans. Western is a kind of man's man savant, a borderline math genius who left academia to race cars in Italy until he went into a coma after a bad wreck. Then, waking up an indeterminate number of months or even years later, decided to live a quiet life of drinking in bars, long philosophical / scientific conversations with fellow blue-collar erudites, and plasma-torching his way into wrecked planes at the bottom of the ocean to recover black boxes. He's the most interesting kind of character to have absolutely zero agency, but more on that later. Basically, he's locked in a permanent state of melancholy because his younger sister, the only woman he ever loved, died several years earlier. She killed herself while he was in his coma. Our time with Bobby begins with him diving down to a wrecked plane that seems to him and the other diver, one of those intellectual blue-collar boys he likes to drink with, named Euler, to not have actually wrecked. Everyone on board is dead, but there is evidence that someone escaped alive. Euler and Bobby suspect the people were assassinated, and the plane was staged as a crash to conceal the truth of what really happened. Bobby's involvement in the dive somehow puts him on the radar of several nondescript federal boogeymen, who first hound Bobby as though he knows something, then put him under surveillance, then impound his car and lock his bank account and also take his passport away. Bobby can't seem to get them to leave him alone, though he moves several times to put them off his trail. Eventually, he forges a new identity and escapes to a small island off the coast of Spain, where he commits to a kind of ascetic future that we don't get to see, because that's where the book ends. Throughout, Bobby has long and interesting conversations with a bunch of very interesting characters. Mostly, I'd say, the plot of the novel isn't important in and of itself. Nothing about the mysteries of the plane or the federal boogeyman or what Bobby supposedly knows is ever resolved. It functions entirely as a lattice for these conversations. The Passenger also has, braided throughout, small chapters that jump in POV to Bobby's sister Alicia while she was still alive. These chapters center on her interactions with the thalidomide kid, a hallucination, or is he, and a principal character in her schizophrenic, or not, delusions. These conversations lead up to her decision to kill herself after her brother falls into his coma and doesn't appear likely to wake up. So that is The Passenger. Stella Maris, meanwhile, takes place entirely at the psychiatric hospital to which Alicia Western commits herself after her brother falls into his coma, but before she kills herself. It's written entirely as dialogue, ostensibly the recorded interactions between her and a psychotherapist who is hoping to publish an article on her. Between her and her brother, Alicia is the true math genius, but perhaps accompanying her genius, or perhaps not, she's also crazy. If she isn't crazy, she might just be seeing through to a deeper and more terrifying truth than the rest of us are capable or willing to perceive. The conversations in Stella Maris are as far-ranging as the conversations in The Passenger, if far less hilarious, but cover the many of the same themes: death, mathematics, despair, trauma, madness, the list goes on. So I'm not going to earmark where we jump from talking about one book to the next. That should maybe be more organic. But I think we should start with The Passenger. And I'll start by asking, were there any conversations that struck either of you as particularly interesting in The Passenger to discuss? Any themes that you felt particularly interested in? Or passages or characters that you were entertained by? I know that's kind of open-ended, but it's kind of a big sandboxy novel. And I think little things that stick out are things maybe that we should start talking about. And I just wanted to start by asking that question.
So, like, Bobby's early conversation with Euler is pretty fantastic. His conversations with John Shadan are pretty great. Maybe the one I liked the most is his discussion with... I listened to the audiobook, and at times it sounded like the narrator was saying W.C. Fields or Debbie C.
Debbie, yeah.
The trans woman.
Yes.
So Bobby is friends with a trans woman, Debbie C., and that very first conversation with her, I really liked a lot. Probably because I'm coming to this as a big fan of McCarthy and having read other stuff by him, and like McCarthy having a trans character that to me seemed rendered really empathetically and really well. Was just interesting. I just thought that was super cool. And then, like, the metaphors are extremely deep. So there's the metaphor of the passenger. So there's the literal passenger who's missing from the plane. And then the thalidomide kid is sometimes referred to as a passenger. Other characters, including Bobby and Alicia, could be passengers in some way. Then there's, you know, I think we could talk about the way various ideas in quantum physics are used as metaphors throughout the novel. Like, there's so much that I hope we get to. Seriously.
We'll try to get to all of it. But you felt like Debbie stood out as a strong character. You liked the conversations because, like, do you? I mean, is that kind of how you read the book too? Like, I don't think the plot really matters.
Oh yeah, and, like, I'm interested in the plot, but like I kind of knew from the beginning. Like, I really thought, oh, yeah, we're not going to find out about, like, this isn't going to resolve. We're not going to find out what this conspiracy is all about. I just thought it was super cool. Like, it's just a book about smart people having smart conversations. It was neat. And being human at the same time. Thought it was awesome.
What do you mean, being human?
Well, like, so take Debbie C. Like, she's rendered empathetically, and you know, like, she just the things that she experiences are kind of common to the human condition, right? Like, obviously, a trans woman is going to have a specific experience, but, like, having a parent that's disappointed in you, other people experience that too, and it's something that we can understand and empathize with. And then there's like John Shadan, who is kind of a cad, you know, but
kind of a cad.
Yeah, very, very much a cad.
He's like, he's profound. He jumps off the page.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's very Falstaffian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not quite in the same kind of, I guess, mentor role as, well, mentor is probably the wrong word. I don't know that he has like a Falstaff Prince Harry relationship to Bobby, but like he reminded me a lot of that kind of character that I guess he's not fat either. So, you know, maybe the comparison breaks down a little, but still.
He does die before the end.
Yeah.
Like there you stuff. Go. So
many people die.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people die.
Like everybody. Everybody but Bobby like dies. It's crazy.
Hans, do you want to, like, I guess this is just sort of like laying out. I don't know. It's hard for me to lay like a starting point for discussing this novel because there is like not a big collective shape to it. There's just a lot of like detail, you know, like things that sort of catch your interest and little facets that face this or that direction that, you know, so I kind of. This might be a messy way of starting it, but I am kind of pleased with how Patrick answered that and just sort of like talking about the novel as a whole, but sort of with respect to its like parts, if that makes sense.
That's kind of always how we do it, isn't it?
I guess. I realized as I was saying that was almost a meaningless statement. But
I'm not trying to avoid discussing the novel by pushing back on the phrasing of your question, which is probably how that came off.
No. It was legitimately like, critical. Yeah.
I first of all, I just, you know, to be clear, like I really, really enjoyed The Passenger. I mean, I enjoyed Still Amaris, but I really enjoyed The Passenger. I did think The Passenger was really brilliant. I really loved it. I really enjoyed it. Had a great, great time reading it. Longtime pod listeners may recall that I have not always responded well to McCarthy, but I really liked The Passenger. It's also, it's hard to talk about a novel like this, I think, not only because it doesn't have a clear structure beyond people talk about things, right? But because, you know, when something doesn't have a kind of clear narrative structure, or when it doesn't have much of a clear narrative structure beyond guy goes somewhere, meets a person, talks to them, it gets hard sometimes even to kind of keep the component pieces in your mind, right? Or to remember everything that happened.
It helped me that I actually read The Passenger twice.
Yeah, and I considered doing that, actually. I would have enjoyed doing that. I just didn't have time before, you know, I didn't have time before the podcast. I think of the three of us, I think I was the only one who hadn't started reading this before we selected it for the podcast. I really, really enjoyed it. Patrick's list of events or Patrick's list of conversations and secondary characters seems pretty, I can't think of any other major ones that he didn't point out, and I can't really think of any favorites that he hasn't already cited, and I definitely don't have the first idea how I would fit all those into some kind of cohesive theme to the extent that they should be, right? And maybe we can talk about whether or not they add up to some kind of cohesive thematic statement, or, you know, is the lack of a cohesive thematic statement its own thematic statement, and, you know, is that a cop-out? I don't know. The only thing I would add, just in terms of kind of an initial framing, I think there's actually, you know, like you characterized this, Chris, and maybe I'm being reductive with how I characterize your characterization, but you described it as a kind of a series of conversations. I would say it's actually a series of conversations and a series of processes, right? It goes back and forth between descriptions of conversations and descriptions of tasks. And I think that the descriptions of the tasks are often just as vivid, just as interesting, maybe just as metaphorically rich as the conversations, right? So like, you know, there's the scene in which he dives into the wrecked plane. There's another scene in which Bobby dives to a sunken tugboat in a river, right? A very, very muddy, essentially, you know, a river so muddy that it's essentially, you can't see in it at all. And he walks across the bottom of the river to the tugboat, right? And that, I thought, was so vividly rendered and so memorable. And I think like the process-based description, I don't know if it's as thematically important as the conversation, but I think it's just as important to the experience of reading the novel. There's a long sequence in maybe like the third quarter where he's hiding out in a farmhouse with no electricity. And it just kind of dwells on the details of that. There's a couple scenes about, you know, getting an old Maserati out of storage that are again, like it's a very, I think it's actually more like 50-50 between dialogue and process. And I think that the process is really striking and was a big, you know, is a big part of how I experienced reading this.
No, I'm glad you pointed that out. I think process is, I'm going to lay this out there because it's wrong. There are a couple of things that jumped into my mind while reading it. And one of the things that jumped into my mind was, and I don't know the proper term for this, but what do you call the Jack Ryan novels
Tom Clancy kind of style spy thrillers?
Tom Clancy and the sort of like absorbing like way in which that sort of genre writes about material or technology or how sort of experts like work on or touch or interface with that technology. There's an aspect of this, of that to this novel too. And that was really part of something that I was enjoying about it, but didn't know how to put a name to.
It's interesting too, because I mean, we've touched a little bit on the idea of Bobby as a protagonist without agency. Right. And the one realm in which he does have agency is, or the one realm in which he does things in a way that suggests agency, is competency of process. He does competent process, and he does it repeatedly throughout the novel. And that's kind of like he has this kind of quality of micro level daily scale hyper competence and agency combined with large scale combined with large scale passivity. And that juxtaposition is really interesting. The other thing, maybe this is too far down, maybe this is me talking about something other than the McCarthy, because I don't know what to say about the McCarthy, but I read Hunt for the Red October a few years ago, just in a situation where it was like, okay, I have like a limited set of options and I'm going to be bored if I don't read something. And the thing that I remember being striking about Hunt for the Red October is it's also, and that's kind of like the Tom Clancy text, right? Like the whole kind of Tom Clancy genre, which I think this kind of exists in relationship to, is kind of, if not born in that, it's like perfectly instantiated in that novel, right? And Hunt for the Red October, my reading of it essentially was, you know, it's an anti-USSR novel, pro-America novel, right? And the reason that the Americans win and the Soviets lose in Hunt for the Red October is because Americans are given the freedom to develop their individual talents, which makes them skilled at process in just the way that Bobby is. And capitalism and freedom win because they give people the space to develop talents in ways which allow them to succeed at process, right? That's actually the message of Hunt for Red October, as I read it. And so it's interesting that, you know, you have that same kind of like process skill here in a novel which is opposed to the U.S. government and its values. I don't think this is explicitly in reaction to Hunt for the Red October, but it does seem like it's kind of in reaction to that broader genre. So I don't know. I don't know if there's anything to be said about that, but it's something that struck me when I was thinking about process and politics here, right? Because a lot of the kind of classic conservative spy thriller basically politicizes process-based skill, if that makes sense.
Yeah, politicizes it and almost fetishizes it. And we have a little bit of that with Bobby. And I don't even think we learn the full scope of his like broad competency. I think I only learned in Stella Maris that he was a musician too, or in a band. So he's just like this super like cool dude that all the ladies like, who like is diving into like sunken wrecks and is a genius and, you know, does all these things super well and super easily. And yet he can't have like a productive conversation with an IRS agent, you know, like he's just not capable of, or he just, you know, can't extricate himself from this broad situation. So on that level, you said, like, sort of on a macro level, he doesn't have agency. And there is a question throughout the novel, and in Stella Maris, I think, to some extent, too, about whether or not we are sort of in charge of our own lives, whether we have choice. In the end, Bobby kind of retreats to an island off the coast of Spain. I can't remember if it's Fermata or something like that. I'm curious, is that a choice? What does that resolve, if anything, in Bobby's story or in resolve in the passenger?
I don't, if it's a choice, it's certainly framed strangely because it's not like we get any, you know, any of the internal chain of events to his mind that leads him to choose to go to, whatever the name of the island is. Like, he just kind of appears there, right? Which is actually, it seems true of other situations in the novel too. Like after he's on the rig out in the Gulf of Mexico, south of Florida for a little bit. And then when that act is over, he just reappears in the bar, the Seven Seas. And similarly, he appears in Spain. So I don't know, like, you know, I think there are a lot of questions, that the novel raises, but like, if I just had to guess, going with my gut instinct, I think that seems like the novel is overall skeptical of human agency, just like it's overall skeptical about a ton of things, right? I'm gonna say no. I don't think it's a choice. And if it resolves something, it simply means that he's out of danger, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to evaluate the meaning of that choice without a better sense of what it is that they want from him, right? What it is that the feds want from him. And it may be that there are internal clues that I'm missing to some of this stuff, right? But I mean, presumably there's something in his father's papers that they want, or something that he has that they think he has of his father's that they want. And, you know, in running from them, is he avoiding giving them something that he thinks would be destructive? Is he running because he doesn't know what they want and he doesn't know how to convince them that he doesn't have what they want? If something bad will happen if he gives them what they want, then in some way, like, effectively hiding out from them is a heroic act, right? It's not just a question of self-preservation. His father, just for context, right, worked on the nuclear bomb, if I'm remembering correctly, right? And it's suggested that there are kind of these two threads that are put together in an uncertain way, right? One is the idea that he's somehow a witness to the cover-up in this plane crash and that they're trying to find him over that. But then there's also, I think, a suggestion that they think that his father, there's some kind of secret that he might have from his father that they want, right? And so,
right.
I think, yeah, I mean, without a little bit clearer sense of the motivation for his hiding, it's a little hard to evaluate the meaning of his hiding beyond the way that it kind of, again, contrasts kind of micro-level competence and macro-level incompetence. But it might be that, I mean, maybe the point is that these authorities are undefeatable.
There's actually, there's actually a fantastic analog for this interpretation you've just put down, Hans, in McCarthy's widely considered best work, Blood Meridian, where that novel is about a group of essentially bounty hunters, scalp hunters. You know, they go around murdering Indians in the late 1800s in, you know, in the West and in Mexico. And one of the characters is simply known as the Kid, similar to the Thalidomide Kid, who is mostly called the Kid in the novel. And the Kid is juxtaposed by this other character called the Judge. And the Kid is mostly like a naive, immature person who doesn't really know what he's getting into, who by the end of the novel transforms into someone more mature, someone who regrets his actions, and ultimately tries in small ways to do good things, or at least things that would help other people suffer less. And the Judge is this character who believes that the quest between, or the conflict between, quote, good and, quote, evil. I put those in quotes because, like, what the judge considers good is certainly not like what normal people would consider good. But the judge believes that the conflict between good and evil is like this essential thing, and he seemingly has magic powers to like essentially do really horrible things that he calls good. And at the end of the novel, there's this final confrontation between the Kid and the Judge that, you know, ends up, I don't want to give anything away in case you guys ever do read it, but, you know, I would say that reading that you've given of this book, Hans, is supported in this other work. So it might be the case that the passenger is doing something similar. Like, even if we're not certain about the agency that Bobby has, construing his what happens at the end of the novel as an attempt to keep the government from, you know, whatever secret that his father may have had. I'm just saying, I think that's interesting and it might be right.
If you're ever put in a position where you think that you may have, you know, seen something that you shouldn't have, or you're like adjacent to some sort of government cover up, and then like a couple of spooks come to your office, you should probably play down the fact that you remember like everything like ever said to you, or
sure,
like that you ever see. Like, you shouldn't be like a fucking smartass, yeah, you know, with those people. You should play like a dumb idiot. Like, he should be a dumb idiot, yeah, and he's not a dumb idiot. He's kind of a smartass,
which is kind of idiotic. You know, to be,
it's really stupid.
So in not being an idiot, he becomes an idiot.
Yeah, you should be like, what were your names again? Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, I thought you were Joey. Oh, shit, okay. So neither of you are disappointed by that. The apparent lack of an arc or resolution for him as a central character in the novel.
Well, the title's kind of a clue to it, isn't it? I mean, it becomes immediately like, you know, you're for maybe the first 50 pages, I thought maybe the passenger being referenced in the title was the missing passenger from the plane. But of course, that's a fake out, right? It pretty quickly becomes clear that he is the passenger. Like, the title signals this is a protagonist without agency. So I was not bothered by that because it's telegraphed so clearly. This is the kind of novel that this is maybe off topic and self-centered, but this is the kind of novel that you should not expose an MFA student to, right? Like,
why?
Because they'll try to write something like it. Because
they'll try to write something like it, right? And you have to be really good to pull it off. My unpublished, unloved first novel is, to a great extent, a passive protagonist having a series of conversations about big themes, right? And it was because
the drug, all the drug users or something?
It's the one about, I don't think there are any drug users in it. That was a novella. It's the one about the computer, computer psychologist that's also a military weapon. Yeah. It's a very, very structureless, amorphous novel. It got a little better in revision, but I mean, it's fundamentally,
I thought it was good.
The big issue is, I mean, I remember it fondly, but I think also if I had... I remember it fondly, but I think if I had approached it from like the very initial planning stages with some idea other than this will be a guy encountering a bunch of interesting people he has conversations with, then it might have been, you know, better for me as a budding craftsman.
So I'm going to move to Stella Maris for this next question, but I think I do want us to keep sort of talking about both novels. But this is a quote from Stella Maris. If the world itself is a horror, then there's nothing to fix, and the only thing you can be protected from is the contemplation of it. That's something that Alicia says to the therapist that she's speaking to, and it struck me as one potential linchpin for getting at the source of tensions in these novels. Several side characters and real figures like the mathematician, who also appears in the novel, Grothendieck, are described as in retreat or having retreated from the various fields of contemplation or engagement. You called them passengers, Patrick, and I think that that's what the passenger's getting at a little bit,
right,
too.
Right, right.
Bobby is in retreat. Alicia seems incapable of retreat, maybe. If we apply this quote as a lens to looking at these novels, does anything in particular jump out for you? Does it lead to any other lines of inquiry?
First, it makes me wonder, like, what is its relationship? Like, how much are we supposed to take this, like, these, like, Alicia's and Bobby's viewpoints as, like, straight? Like, the viewpoints of the novels, or the novel, or however you want to, the two works. Like, I wonder how much we're supposed to identify with them, because, like, that statement, if the world is itself a horror, there's nothing to fix, and the only way you can be protected from it is the contemplation of it. Like, that is almost exactly mirrored in certain sentiments of pessimistic philosophy, where, you know, one writer of pessimism... has said that, you know, thinking about these issues does actually make your life worse. Like, constantly thinking about how life is meaningless and a tragedy and worthless makes your life worse. So you should probably think about that less often, as a legitimate, practical way of trying to be happier. So it really makes me wonder, like, is this something that we're meant to, like, to take out of the novel as a real thing? Or is this said more in irony? Or maybe it's, if we're talking about, like, Grothendieck and some of the other characters who retreated from physics or mathematics, maybe it's simply a comment about, like, what really happens, if that makes sense. Like, yeah, you look at something that doesn't make sense and you seem to come to the core of some kind of mystery that you can't puzzle out. So people are naturally going to back away from it. I don't know.
I mean, we talked earlier about the possibility that Bobby, in hiding out in this island in Spain from the feds, Bobby is trying to protect the world from some piece of knowledge that they would get from him, that he retained somehow from his father, right? Some kind of like, I mean, his father worked on the atomic bomb, so presumably some kind of atomic-related, nuclear weapon-related secret, I would guess. And if we grant that that is what he is doing, if we grant that he is kind of sacrificing the opportunity to do things like drive a Maserati and dive and have a cat and, you know, keep in touch with all his old friends so that he may protect the world from whatever kind of secret is in his head. I know that's a big if, right?
Right.
But if we're reading the novel in that way, or if nothing else, if we're reading the novel in the way that he believes that, right, then that contradicts that statement, doesn't it? Right. I mean, he's not fixing anything perhaps, but he is in fact protecting, he is protecting the world from something other than the horror of itself. And he's doing so in a way which probably involves a great deal of solitary contemplation of the horror of the world. So if he's, if we read that as being the meaning of that final action, it's, I think, off the top of my head, a drastic, maybe not drastic, but a very clear contradiction of the quote that you've pulled out, Chris.
That's interesting. I like that. Go ahead, Patrick.
Oh, I was just going to say, in which case we would read this line as ironic or not something that we're supposed to take out of the novel if we read the ending of The Passenger as an example of Bobby trying to do something good for the world by hiding whatever secret mass weapon his dad came up with, then yeah, this is, we are not meant to follow this this quote from his sister.
Well, I don't know if I read it as ironic. I think it's sincere from Alicia's point of view.
Oh yeah,
Alicia is definitely, incredibly. She's a very earnest sufferer.
Yeah.
Bobby is a more unwilling participant in suffering. Like, I think I want to read these two novels again, having read Stella Maris.
Yeah, man.
And. Yeah, and I think it's interesting to sort of, we haven't talked about their relationship at all, and I don't know that we have time to do, like, I don't know that I even really understand what the relationship is to these novels, other than a kind of off-screen inciting event for Bobby's, you know, bottomless sort of melancholy, and Alicia's. It's almost like Romeo and Juliet, right? Where like each of them is given the opportunity to like either really live through the other's death or perceive that they've lived through the other's death, and it basically destroys both of them.
I like that you bring up Romeo and Juliet for the simple fact that I like that, you know, it's a famous tragedy. And I kind of think that's what McCarthy is going for here, which is like a tragedy of Shakespearean proportion. And I like, this is all wrapped up in the question of why these books are separate and what all the quantum physics is about. So I've come up with my own answer to this question.
Do it.
Okay.
Answer the question.
So I read The Passenger. Then when Stella Maris came out, I read it. And I was like, when I read The Passenger, I was like, huh, I don't really get this. I like it, but I don't get it. Then I read Stella Maris and I was like, oh, okay. So this is the same thing. This is the same novel. And something really clicked. Like, I felt like the dimensions of like the basically the tragedy became more alive for me. So I was like, but still I have questions. So I reread The Passenger, and as I was doing that, I thought initially this is the same novel and they should just be together, and there's no reason that they couldn't have been except for some bullshit marketing thing. And that could still be the case, but my answer now is that Bobby and Alicia's relationship is like quantum entanglement, in the sense that we don't see Bobby and Alicia together that often. For most of these, both of the novels, they're separate from one another, and there are only actually a few scenes where they're together. And yet, like entangled particles, they are, totally determined, or, you know, they're affected deeply by the state of the other, despite the distance and time between them. And then I got to thinking about time and how physics perceives time. And I thought, well, maybe, like, the way these works use time is actually pretty interesting, because it's not just flashbacks, right? Like, it's not just Bobby having flashbacks. So, like, the first time we see Alicia in The Passenger, she's talking to, well, the first time we actually see her is that first little opening where she's dead, in the snow, found by a hunter. But then after that, it's a week before her death, and she's talking to the thalidomide kid. And then throughout the rest of the novel, we see her at different stages, and those, like, sometimes we see her at 12, sometimes we see her at 16, sometimes we see her at 14, sometimes at 18. And, like, there's nothing linear about it, right? Like, sometimes, like, you know, McCarthy just kind of picks and chooses different ages. And, even when Bobby remembers things, time seems to be like a lost quality. Like in the present of The Passenger, he recalls when he got the buried treasure from his parents' house. We don't know exactly when that happened. We don't know, we know it happened beforehand. So basically what I'm saying is that I think that there are a lot of nods to different quantum physical properties, like entanglement and, like, maybe even retrocausation and weird things like that in the structure of these books. And it makes me think that one could actually read Stella Maris before The Passenger. I wonder if, like, that's actually a thing that is accomplished by publishing it separately, that we can think of it as different in time, maybe. I don't know. I hope that's cogent, what I said.
I think it is, because it kind of puts a different spin. That's a little math joke.
Different quark spin, different gluon spin.
Yeah, different spin on something that I noticed, which is that the person that Alicia is talking to, the psychotherapist, mm-hmm. He asks her questions about the thalidomide kid that I think she asks the thalidomide kid in The Passenger.
Mm.
There's a few of them that pop up. What do you do in your free time? is one very specific one that I remembered.
Right.
And it's, that's, you know, that's a kind of like, that's a kind of a silly little detail that like feels like, oh, the, you know, this is the same person.
Mm.
But I think McCarthy is just too careful and too spare to waste time doing that shit just to kind of like knit like, oh, yeah, like this Alicia is that Alicia. And this the thalidomide kid that she's talking about here is the thalidomide kid that she's talking to right. here. That's unnecessary. He doesn't even like write, you know, about how Bobby gets back from Venezuela.
Right, right, right.
I don't remember where he goes. So like
Florida.
I feel like there's something in what you're saying. I like that. And it does. I was sort of interested whether these books were separate entirely to make twice as much money.
Yeah, I wondered that too. And I don't.
Because it's kind of fucking expensive, right. McCarthy, to have to buy two goddamn
books. Hardcovers. Even
yeah.
I don't know. I like the pessimist part of the pessimist part of me thinks, oh, that this is just some bullshit. You know, they just want to make more money. But I can see an interpretation in the novel based on quantum physics as a metaphor that makes putting these two books separate. Like that it makes it useful and that makes it worthwhile. So
shall I'm curious what is it that Alicia sees in one of her visions, the Arcatron? She describes seeing something as though through a Judas hole. And I don't know what that is. I meant to look that up before this pod. Do either of you know what that is?
A peephole in a door?
No.
A Judas hole, you know, to see out your doorway in a.
Oh, I've never heard that term.
In an apartment building. Yeah.
So she sees through something like that into a realm where there are beings at a gate, and there's something in the gate that is terrible, and she has this vision. I think she says when she was 10. And it permanently sort of undermines her, like, comfort with reality, I guess it's easiest to say. And it's not really, I think that it's, Alicia is pretty lucid in discussing whether she is or is not crazy, and that it is, in and of itself, makes it hard to sort of, like, read her as having some sort of actual mental illness. But I don't know. I mean, like, obviously that doesn't disqualify her from having a mental illness. She's, you know, she's just an incredibly brilliant person. And part of her brilliance is kind of her ability to maybe confuse herself about what is real. Mm. But I just curious, like, what is that thing that she sees? Is that... what is that thing that she thinks she sees or senses?
I mean, is it just a vision of hell?
McCarthy is, you know, McCarthy, I think, better than Hans or I. Is McCarthy interested in, like, heaven and hell in mythology?
Oh man, I don't know. Like, he does. He doesn't really do interviews to explain his work. So like I have like I could you know, like I think you could read his work as, you know, that of a very conservative old dude or as like a radical. I just don't know. I don't know. So like certainly his work is interested in things of mythic proportion. But I don't know whether that... So, I mean, I think his work is interested in things of mythic proportion. So probably his work is interested in heaven and hell, at least as concepts, if not, you know, real things. And, you know, like, there's definitely, like, talk of the afterlife. Like, Alicia seems to think that there is no afterlife specifically for her. Whereas, Bobby's vision of Shadan in Spain could indicate that Bobby believes in an afterlife.
He hopes that she does at multiple points. Sure. He asks whether she does of people who, which is interesting. But go on.
I would say he probably, you know, McCarthy's novels are probably interested in heaven and hell. And I think that certainly there are little things in this novel that indicate maybe, like, if Bobby's vision of Shadan is any indicator, then maybe that's more of a hopeful idea about the afterlife.
Yeah, but unverifiable.
Unverifiable, because, yes.
You know, people might just be seeing shit.
Right. Like, yeah. Like, Bobby, after all, does end up seeing, you know, the flipper guy.
Thalidomide kid.
So, like, what if, you know, why would that happen? How could that happen? Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, he had the thalidomide kid described to him. So
I guess it's just his own hallucination born from his own grief.
Basically, there's it's almost like a math proof problem that trying to gather data from the inside of a black hole, right? Like, it's like this impossible sort of threshold, and then we face that with the afterlife.
Right.
And a lot of the anxiety in the novel, in both novels, it seems to kind of come from, you know, this uncrossable threshold.
Right.
That, and then, you know, Alicia has a real true death wish. Like, she just wants to not exist. Like, she has a real tortured soul, and, unfortunately, she's entangled with Bobby, so she carries Bobby along with her. So, Hans, did you have anything more?
I really don't on that topic. No, I'm so committed to the, maybe committed is the wrong word. It seems so self-evident to me that there isn't an afterlife, that, like, any kind of rumination in a book on the nature of the afterlife is, it's not uninteresting, but it just kind of seems like piffle, you know? I have trouble connecting with it as anything other than just, like, the vague wish of a character. And so, as opposed to a meaningful thematic statement, right? Like, if a book offers an idea about the nature of tyranny or government, that's an interesting, meaningful thematic statement. If a book offers an idea about the nature of the afterlife, that's just, it's interesting perhaps from a character standpoint, but it doesn't say anything about the world, you know? For just the reason that you pointed out, and that it is kind of a math-proof problem, right? It's this thing that exists on the other side of this uncrossable threshold. I think the black hole comparison is a very good one. But I mean, one thing one result of that is I'm just not very good at, like, even to the extent that it does reveal character, it's kind of a blind spot for me, honestly, in literary analysis. There are a certain number of things that are hallucinations or visions that I guess you could interrogate the reality of, but there's so little textual evidence, right? I mean, if Bobby sees the thalidomide kid, are we to believe that that means the thalidomide kid has some reality beyond just being a delusion, or are we to believe that that means Bobby is just having, you know, his own delusion at that moment that is kind of resonating in images that he had described to him by his sister? I don't have a particularly good answer. I would assume it's the latter, right? I think when I was reading it, I actually for a minute thought maybe it was meant to be the former, but I would assume it would be, on reflection, I would think it would be the latter. Because, the latter is the only thing that has, it's the only thing that would have meaning, right? Otherwise, it just kind of turns into, like, Twin Peaks. And I like Twin Peaks, but, you know, the thalidomide kid kind of is like a Black Lodge character, right?
I think, like, what has meaning, the way that I'm reading it, is that it is, Bobby is in the position as an observer, and I am kind of, I'm sort of like veering toward like sort of math proof language now, I guess, but like as an observer to, you know, like not to want to think, but to know otherwise. So like there's a desire to believe, you know, that he will see Alicia again, and that, you know, seeing and having a conversation with the thalidomide kid in a dream, you know, could like, is like a kind of like a some scant hope, but that's in tension with, you know, his brain.
Just as an aside, it's interesting to me that since we're talking a little bit in kind of passing about the thalidomide kid, of all the aspects and portions of the novel, we haven't talked at all about the, that I can remember, we haven't talked at all about the brief passages spread throughout The Passenger where Alicia talks to the thalidomide kid, have we? Not much. I mean, I think of all the different kind of moving parts here, those were the bits I was most mystified by and maybe aesthetically the least entertained by. And I don't know if I don't have a real clear sense of what we would lose if those were not here. Since we do have such a vivid sense of Alicia and Stella Maris, it just, many of them just kind of seemed incoherent to me, right? And I'm curious if there's anything that you think I'm missing in saying that, or like what function they're serving beyond just to like a kind of rhythmic one in punctuating the pace of The Passenger.
That's how I experienced them. I mean, I think part of it is that the thalidomide kid is a cipher, like to Alicia, you know, and it's hard to kind of understand what he might be doing if like the one human brain in the room also doesn't understand what he's doing. And it's interesting to see her relationship to him, I think, and how it changes over time, and how it doesn't change in one direction, but like basically like she has a kind of warmth toward him, a concern that I think is interesting and complicated when you think, oh, but, you know, she's also sort of convinced that he's not real, or maybe she thinks that he might be real. I think it's actually very interesting. It's I don't know. I think McCarthy did it really well, but I also, like, I need to read it again to have Alicia sort of, like, be in a kind of quantum, we're using these terms, but I think I say quantum here, but it's actually just like a very rich, complicated, rife with internal contradictions, sort of like knowing one thing, but also simultaneously knowing another thing, relationship with her own delusions. You know, like there's a kind of a wariness to her externally where she doesn't seem to want to be helped or to want to be understood. And maybe that is sort of reflected internally with like her unwillingness to understand herself or her inability to understand herself. And she's, I think that that's done really well. I think that the parts in The Passenger that kind of serve as a piece of that, that gets further clarified in Stella Maris, taken just in The Passenger, are really kind of hard to do anything with. I had the same experience as you, Hans. Like, I just wanted to kind of like read like the thalidomide kid being like a nutter, but I didn't know what to do with it. It was I'd rather spend time with John Chadan, you know. So
I think that if we only have Alicia in Stella Maris, then we don't actually ever see her internally. We see her in conversation, and that's outside of her mind. So I do think we lose something if we lose the interludes where she's discussing stuff with the kid. So I wouldn't want to lose it there. And if the kid is a delusion and Alicia is a schizophrenic, you would expect these conversations to be incoherent. So that makes sense to me. But you know, I think you, Chris, you said some things like, you know, you wondered if like these conversations are her unwillingness or inability to understand herself. And I think that's perfectly reasonable. So, and if we don't have the conversations with the kid, we miss out on two other things. That is the metaphor of time, which I talked about earlier in relationship to why these books are separate. Like we miss out on the use of time as a metaphor and the use of like the strange way in which this novel uses time. And we also miss a reference to, you know, the cancer babies that came from nuclear testing, you know, thalidomide. Yeah. So I actually think we lose a lot. Like I think you're dead wrong.
You recant, Hans. Recant, or go straight to the Arcatron.
I don't know. I just think we lose a lot if we lose these passages. Even if I do agree that they are less entertaining than like Bobby talking to John Chadan or Euler or even his cat. They're less entertaining. They don't seem to make sense, but they still seem necessary to me.
All right. Is there anything else that either of you guys want to say about either of these novels? I'll say that I enjoyed them a ton. I think Stella Maris was the weaker of the two, just in terms of just like line by line experience and kind of like overall sort of complexity. But I think that doesn't mean that it's not worth it, or that like reading them in conjunction, they kind of compound each other in interesting ways.
Definitely.
I really liked both of them, you know, quite a bit.
I think I'd retreat from the statement about, you know, liking Stella Maris less. Like, even if they are separate books, I feel like they're kind of integral to one another. It's less funny. I agree with that.
Oh my God, it's way less funny. God, The Passenger is fucking hilarious. Which it is fucking hilarious.
The Passenger is funny, which McCarthy doesn't do that often. Like, you know, I was intrigued, you know, because I have been like, I haven't talked about this, but I've been looking forward to this novel for years. So by like back in 2016 or 2015, it was announced that McCarthy was going to have a new novel after The Road, and it was called The Passenger. And then they announced that it was going to be released, and then it was retracted. And until recently, it's like been in limbo. I was like, well, when are we going to get this fucking book? What's going on? Why did this happen? Why is it retracted? And I don't know why it was retracted, but, you know, maybe he just wasn't done yet. Maybe. But what was my point? What was I trying to get at? I forget.
You enjoyed it.
It's great.
You thought it was funny. You mentioned the funny part.
The only other novel that he's written that's funny is Sutri. And it's not as good as this, but it's funny too. It's just not something he usually does.
Hans, what overall sort of take feelings about the novels?
I liked them both a lot. I mean, I said at the beginning, I think that I liked them both a lot. I mean, The Passenger is just so much more immersive, and it's so much more visually intense, and it just kind of, it's something that you live in for a much longer period of time, I think. It's a much richer experience just by nature of, pretty inevitably a much richer experience just by nature of how it's constructed. And you could probably, I think that I could read The Passenger by itself without having read Stella Maris and not feel as though something was missing. I think Stella Maris does feel a little bit more like a companion piece in some ways, honestly. Mm-hmm. I do think that they work well together. I think that they work well together thematically. And I mean, I think that like The Passenger kind of answers Stella Maris thematically in some subtle ways that we've talked about. If I had read Stella Maris first, I might have had an easier time following The Passenger, honestly. I mean, it took probably 70 or 80 pages to be... It took 70 or 80 pages of about, I think, 380 before I really felt like I'd kind of settled into how to follow what was happening in a way where I was paying attention to the right things. And I think if I'd read the... I mean, Stella Maris, if nothing else, like, fills in some plot details that I found a bit opaque on first read of The Passenger.
Mm-hmm.
Though, you know, of course, I think if I had read Stella Maris without having read The Passenger, I might have found Stella Maris more opaque because I didn't have the plot details from The Passenger. I mean, they're kind of symbiotic in that way. The question of which is better is a kind of maybe a dead end, but I mean, there's much more to enjoy in The Passenger if for no other reason than it's just a much longer book that I don't think is any less dense line by line. And when you guys were talking about, you know, whether or not it was just a cash grab to publish them separately, I was trying to imagine how you would integrate the two. And I don't know if you could do that without, I mean, because The Passenger already has the Alicia sections intercut with the Bobby sections, I'm not sure that you could integrate the two without too much of a series of choppiness, right? Or without kind of taking us out of the Bobby sections in ways which were bad for the pacing of those sections. So maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I mean, without, you know, going through and making a mock-up, it's kind of a irrelevant, you know, question, I guess. But
I thought what the best solution would simply be to call the whole thing The Passenger, label Bobby's novel Part 1 and Stella Maris Part 2, and just publish it as one thing. I don't like the idea of like integrating it like you said, because it would be choppy. But to me, like, even if they are separate pieces, they feel to me very integral. So publishing them as one does like just because of the physical object, you would think of it as one novel. And I think you could do that if you just label it as part one and part two.
Plus, it would save you $20. Other thing that you're,
save us $20. It should save you $20. Fucking bastards.
Publishers. No, but I think, too, like, the thing that you're saying that makes me think of is The Passenger is just, like, 20 times better a title than Stella Maris.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, kind of, like, unlocking what these...
Like, what is there's no multiple meanings to Stella Maris. You know, The Passenger has depth of meaning, and Stella Maris just it's just the place, it's just the loony bin she's at.
Yeah. Well, Oh, go ahead, Hans.
I should have looked this up before the podcast. I had the vague impression that Stella Maris, the name Stella Maris, does have some meaning. Name of something. Well, maybe not. I don't know. I had the idea in my head that it was the name of a ship, but maybe I'm just completely... I've been trying to Google that, and my...
It sounds like it's Latin or something, like Sea of Stars. Does that make sense?
So Stella Maris refers to Mary leading us to Christ. Catholics call the Virgin Mary Stella Maris. This title for Mary arose in the 5th century. This is just all Google research here, right? So St. Jerome was doing a bit of translating and translated Mary's Hebrew name Miriam into the Latin Stella Maris. So Mary has often been invoked as Stella Maris by those who make their livelihoods on the sea. She has been called the calmer of storms. So, yeah, it's a name for the Virgin Mary that has that ties in with the idea of her as a guiding figure, apparently primarily for sailors.
And Bobby is a type of sailor. Still, The Passenger as a title is better.
It's a better title.
All right. Well, I think that brings us to a close today. Thank you for talking about The Passenger and Stella Maris by Cormac McCarthy with me today, guys.
My pleasure.
It was on. I really do. Just read The Passenger and like luxuriate in it. You know, like it's just a fun,
super good,
deep, weird, super good novel. And then move on to Stella Maris afterward, and then bounce back to The Passenger.